It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 26, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times, in the fashionable dollar lunch district of New York City. Today on the program, from The Nation magazine, editor and publisher Katrina Vandenhuvel, on the ongoing war on women and the protests that are going to be taking place this weekend. Marches, so that we can get to that point where women are considered. Maybe we don't want to push it first class citizens, but maybe like three quarter class citizens in this country. Also on the program today, Mike Sachs from the Huffington Post on the Supreme Court oral arguments yesterday involving SB 1070, the Arizona immigration law. Lots in the news today. Rupie Murdoch, he is in some hot water. We will be discussing that later in the program. Also, fracking. Pennsylvania is really turning into sort of just like a little sort of petri dish for how the fracking industry is going to frack all of us. Frack up our water, frack up our bodies, and then probably sell the fracking crap to some other country at a minimal benefit to anyone in this country. Good news, though, however. You remember Charles Taylor. He was that very nice gentleman who was the leader of Liberia, and was charged with aiding and abetting war crimes during the Sierra Leone Civil War. He is 64 years old. He's been on trial at The Hague in a UN-backed special court for almost, been close to 5 years. Rebels killed thousands in the Sierra Leone's 10-year civil war in the 90s, which I think actually went into the early aughts. Well, he was convicted, I believe, yesterday or today, of 11 counts, including terror, murder, and rape, but cleared of ordering the crimes. Taylor is the first former head of state convicted by an international court since the Nuremberg Military Tribunal of Nazis after World War II. Over the next day or so, I'm going to be talking to Glenn Greenwald about some of the war crimes that have been committed in the past 10 years in this country that seem to be completely, we got to turn the page. We've been talking a little bit about that. We'll be talking to Glenn Greenwald, and we'll be playing that interview over the next couple of days. Meanwhile, Bradley Manning hearings taking place this week. I mentioned this briefly, I think, in the better half of the program the other day. But just to give you a little more depth on the motions filed by Bradley Manning's attorney, David Coombs, he has been asking for key documents under discovery from the prosecution, which he says are crucial to Manning getting a fair trial. Well, of course. And this is the thing. Understand that Manning now, I think, has been in custody for 23 months, approximately. He's tried to obtain, this is Coombs, access to the damage assessments by the U.S. intelligence experts. In other words, when Manning, accused of leaking these State Department cables and all this other materials that apparently, like I said, I think literally, I think over a couple of million people had access to these things. Coombs is trying to get the assessment as to supposedly what damage was done by the leak of these things. I mean, if you're going to charge a guy with espionage, an offense which could carry the death penalty, it seems incumbent upon the prosecution to say, this is what you caused. And if it's a question of, well, we don't want to cause further damage, then you redact a bunch of this stuff. But there's so far no evidence that there's been any real threat to the U.S. national security because of these leaks. Unless you say that having just sort of an informed citizenry is somehow de facto a problem for the national security of any given country, they should show it. Coombs also wants to see transcripts of grand jury proceedings held in Virginia, where the U.S. government is attempting to build a criminal case against Julian Assange, because Coombs, like many people, is convinced that the reason why Bradley Manning is being treated so harshly is simply because they want him to, in some way, implicate Julian Assange. Listen, it has taken 2 years since the case began for the defense to get only 12 pages of discovery materials. And apparently those materials are dated November 2010. And the defense is only receiving them now. I mean, so it's clear there's something very hinky going on here. And that what we're witnessing is a serious miscarriage of justice. Meanwhile, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mike Sachs, reporter from Huffington Post, on Arizona's SB 1070, discussed at the Supreme Court yesterday. Hi, folks. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For Majority Report listeners, you can get a free downloadable book, audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. Go and download FUBAR, the book that I wrote with Stephen Sherrill, I guess 6 years ago. Still apt today. Should be mildly amusing for you, or get a Chomsky book. Either way, it's free. audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. Check it out. It's a free book. audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Mike Sachs, a reporter from Huffington Post. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Sam.
SB 1070 was being argued at the Supreme Court yesterday. Just give us a little background on, I mean, I think most people are familiar with that law, but give us some of the broad strokes.
Okay, there were four provisions of SB 1070 that were blocked in the lower courts as treading on the federal government's exclusive control over immigration policy. The biggest one that was argued for most of the 80 minutes yesterday was a section called 2B. It requires police to ask anyone they stop, detain, or arrest for immigration papers if the officer reasonably suspects that the person is undocumented. And it also requires police to check the immigration status of anyone arrested before those people are released from police custody. That's the most controversial one. That's the one that allows the police, really, when they pull someone over to say, hey, you look like an undocumented immigrant, give me your papers. It has a racial profiling element to it. But at the court yesterday, Chief Justice Roberts made it very clear that the racial profiling and discrimination aspects that have made SB 1070 so controversial were not in play in this case. It really was a technical matter of whether or not these provisions of SB 1070 tread on the federal government's exclusive prerogative to police federal immigration policy.
Okay, now wait, let me stop you there. Let me stop you there because, all right, so this is the part that I'm not fully clear on. Now I understand I understand that the law is being challenged. The federal government needs to have the capacity to have a cohesive immigration policy. And if Arizona is doing something that interferes with that, they have a problem with it. But why is there no discussion of the implications of racial profiling? Is that simply just another case, or is that because the lower courts struck that down?
Several reasons. Not because the lower court struck it down at all. It's because the federal government made a strategic move to just bring a preemption challenge as opposed to an equal protection challenge or a challenge that this thing is racially motivated. They did that probably because they know the makeup of the Supreme Court as it is. The makeup of the Supreme Court is with five conservatives are very reluctant to say that anyone or anything is being racist. Instead, they're probably more likely to favor the federal government if the federal government brings a drier, more abstract technical challenge. Now, that ended up not being the case yesterday with the justices from right to left believing that at least this section, the papers please section, is really just a kosher way of cooperating with the federal government's own interest in finding out who is illegal and who is not in the country.
Will the administration, will the federal government have a second bite at this apple? Because, all right, so you have the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has blocked at least the implementation of some of the aspects of the law, correct?
Right. Yes.
And so, if those aspects of the law get implemented, will then the Department of Justice have an opportunity to say, okay, now we have a problem because you're actively engaged in racial profiling?
Absolutely, and so will civil rights groups and individuals who've already brought suit, and those suits are pending this current decision. So if these sections get unblocked and they're allowed to be enacted in Arizona and similarly in other states that have followed suit, then you will have civil rights groups bringing actions saying that this thing is racially discriminatory in violation of the 14th Amendment. It violates people's Fourth Amendment rights for unreasonable searches and seizures. It violates people's Sixth Amendment rights to be confronted with the evidence against them. All these things will come forward in subsequent challenges. Whether courts below or this Supreme Court will be sympathetic to those challenges will really depend on the amount of evidence that individuals actually impacted by these laws can bring in trial and then going forward.
Okay, so at this point, because these laws aren't yet sort of being executed or implemented, it may be difficult to argue standing in certain situations because you haven't been in any way a victim of these laws.
Exactly. It's a facial challenge. And unless the government could have proven that in the drafting and implementation of the laws, the legislatures were going on record saying, I hate brown people, then you would have a very hard time proving it in court, and especially in front of these particular Supreme Court justices.
Okay. And so the argument, so this comes down to, in many respects, sort of a relatively dry question of the federal authority versus state authority. The argument from Arizona is that we're in no way impinging upon the federal authority. We're simply assisting them. But the argument from the federal government is that you don't have the mechanism in which to implement our laws, A. B, we have nuance in the context of our immigration laws, where we have basically a high priority to deport certain people, a lower priority to deport others, and that's a function of sort of domestic policy. If we're less interested in deporting, young children who were brought here,
speeding.
Yeah, and also there's also a question of, we have relationships with we have geopolitical concerns as to who we might deport.
Right. And the Solicitor General yesterday leaned heavily on those geopolitical concerns, the prospect of pissing off a country to our southern border if we indiscriminately make quite discriminatively, if you will, put into jail many foreign nationals for existing illegally in our country. And that argument seemed to actually gain some traction with the justices. The two provisions that were blocked criminalized being in the country without registering with the federal authorities and seeking work or getting work without proper documentation. And those two things, the Solicitor General convincingly pointed to moments when Congress was redrafting its immigration laws, it chose to punish employers rather than the employees for seeking out for seeking out work and obtaining work in the United States. So those criminal sanctions that go above and beyond the civil penalties that Congress had chosen to go with, those look like they'll remain blocked. The justices seem pretty, except for perhaps Justice Scalia, who was a Fox News caricature yesterday, as he's increasingly become, those criminal sanctions seem to put a bad taste in the justice's mouth, again, from right to left yesterday.
This is the thing I think that most people don't realize, is that to be undocumented in this country is not in and of itself a criminal violation. It's a civil violation.
Right. Yeah. And you can be deported. And that's, you know, I think the Obama administration has actually been very profligate in deporting people from the country who are not here with proper documentation. But it's never been it's not a criminal offense at all. And that's where Arizona likely stepped over the line, where the justices will likely say so.
And so when will we when do we expect to get a ruling on this?
The end of June, perhaps even the very last day, coming down in tandem with the health care cases, probably the last Monday or the last Thursday in June, depending on how quickly they write the opinion.
Oh, great. Well, that should be an interesting day. Mike Sacks, yeah, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, no problem. Love to come back.
Okay, great. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with a little more. We got we're going to dip into the presidential elections. We'll talk a little bit about Republicans, but also Lawrence Lessig coming out strong for Americans Elect. Very interesting situation. We'll talk about that. Also coming up, Rupert Murdoch, a little bit of hot water. We'll be right back after this. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Quite a day for Team Romney yesterday. I would be remiss if I didn't pay any attention to the presidential election. I think this is the first time I've talked about it in days, anyways. Mitt Romney taking the offensive. I got to tell you something right now. My sense is Mitt Romney is going to lose quite badly. I think, you know, the narrative, I think the economy is still, frankly, in the crapper. There is some doubt as to whether or not the narrative is going to be that the economy is still in the crapper. But I think the actual implications of what people are feeling is not going to change one way or another. Because I think the economy is in the crapper right now. And we're going to have nearly 700,000 people who are going to fall off the rolls of unemployment, as of the next couple of months. I don't think we're going to see any big uptick in employment for quite some time. We're starting to see more foreclosures. You know, every other month it seems that we get the message that the real estate market has bottomed out. I'm not buying it. Or maybe it's maybe it's bottomed out, but it's going to hang there for a while. So I mean, I think barring any unforeseen developments, I think Mitt Romney is just such a horrible candidate. But there are times where it's amusing, and this is one of those times where the Romney campaign is pretty amusing. Vice President Biden is going to make a speech today attacking Mitt Romney's foreign policy. And so Romney organized the camp a conference call with three of Romney's foreign policy advisors to push back on this speech that's coming from Biden. Every time Mitt Romney goes out and campaigns, he loses votes. And it seems that every time they have one of their advisors come out and say anything in defense of Romney, he becomes more of a laughingstock. Listen to this. This is Romney advisor, Ambassador Pierre Prosper. attacking President Obama's foreign policy. And let's see if you catch this.
The result is that the United States has become a spectator on issues of national security. We've also been, you know, embarrassed by North Korea, where, again, it continues to be a retaliatory, leaning forward approach, and yet the North Koreans will launch a missile surprising the United States, violating their agreement.
Pause. Now, you know, what you're hearing is somebody typing down, taking notes. This is a conference call recorded by reporters. And, you know, this is the standard Republican fare. President Obama has been too apologetic on the foreign stage. He apologizes to people. He's very polite. But listen to this part.
Russia is another example of where we give Russia gifts and we get nothing in return. The United States abandoned its missile defense sites in Poland and Czechoslovakia. Yet Russia does nothing but obstruct us with our efforts in Iran, Syria, and even worse, the president.
Okay, so there he is. President Obama abandoned its missile defense sites in Poland and Czechoslovakia. Now, apparently, President Obama did this, I think, sometime shortly after he graduated from Harvard Law School. Because Czechoslovakia hasn't been Czechoslovakia in 15, 20 years. You've got your foreign policy experts sort of just offhandedly naming countries that still aren't there anymore. Now, fortunately for the Obama administration, this guy never took Obama on his policy towards Prussia. Or the Ottoman Empire, because that has been atrocious. But so there you have it, folks. Mitt Romney's advisor and Mitt Romney's hopeful vice president. Of course, I'm talking about Marco Rubio, who really has no chance to be vice president, I think. But this is a guy, Marco Rubio. Now, I don't care about these type of flubs, other than the fact it just goes to show the principle that I have stated over and over again, which is that when you start to adopt mainstream conservative, I don't even want to call it ideology, because it's not really an ideology. It's just simply a disposition, which means that you have to become immediately a huge flaming a-hole. I don't know how else to put that. You inevitably, it comes back to bite you in the ass. In the New York Times Magazine, 2010, Rubio says, President Obama, quote, is the most articulated, talented teleprompter reader in America. In February 2010, in the New York Times, the president couldn't find anywhere to set up a teleprompter to announce new taxes, Rubio said at CPAC. At the National Conservative Student Conference in 2011, I doubt I'll be able to give you the best speech you've ever heard. My teleprompter got left at the office, said Rubio. And in February 9th in 2012, quoted in the Nation magazine, it's hard to get a teleprompter in this town. There's someone who uses it a lot. You know, just being a general a-hole. Look, the bottom line is all politicians use teleprompters. And apparently, or I should say, they use teleprompters or paper to read their speeches. Unless Rubio is somehow different. I don't know. Let's tune into his foreign policy speech at the Brookings Institution just to see how a real maestro does it.
The 21st century provides us the opportunity for more freedom, a world where more people are free to grow their economies, free to pursue their dreams, free to become prosperous. I left my last page of the speech. Does anybody have my last page? Did I leave it with you?
I apologize.
Above all else, the 21st century provides us the opportunities for more freedom.
Ooh. I'm shocked. It just goes to show you, you cannot be a right-wing a-hole and have it not come back upon you at one point. And finally, we no longer have Newt Gingrich to kick. Well, of course, we still have him to kick around anymore. But apparently, he ran out of books on his book tour and no longer needs to stay on the campaign trail. He owes $4 million. Well, not him. His campaign does. And I don't know what happens with that debt. I think it just sits there. Because I think Tiffany's is ahead of in line for a creditor for the Gingrich family. So no more Newt Gingrich. We will get back to the we're going to stay off the presidential trail for a while. However, just I want to briefly touch on this. I'm going to see maybe if I can get Lessig on the program to talk about this. But Lawrence Lessig has a piece in The Atlantic today that very forcefully, I don't know if this is an endorsement of Buddy Romer, but it is, he is endorsing the American elect. Is that what it is? The Americans elect, which is this online process that has been funded by very wealthy people to, and they have managed to get on the ballot in every state. They will have an online system of getting delegates, and the delegates will choose a presidential and a vice presidential candidate. The only rules are that the president and the vice president cannot be from the same party. Lessig sits on the board of Americans Elect. He's not a paid it's not a paid position. He makes a very compelling case that this could be the last opportunity to address the corruption of our politics by money. And I want to read just a little bit of it because we've talked a lot about this in the better half over the weeks and the months as to whether or not, you know, by supporting or voting for Obama, are we giving up our last chance to change our politics? And he puts it quite interestingly. And, you know, I must concede that I'm, you know, it's going to make me take another a look at this. He says, and it, as you know, Lessig has been working on this for, I don't know, past 3 or 4 or 5 years, how to get corruption out of our politics. And he's convinced that it's campaign finance is essentially the only way to do this. And he writes, if it's almost certain that the next president will be either Romney or Obama, does it make sense to jeopardize the chances of the candidate on our side from the left, Obama, from the right, Romney, by pushing this issue back into the debate? That is the corruption of our politics by money. Because, look, both parties and presidential candidates are a function of just an enormous amount of money. He writes, is this issue important, or should we just accept that this isn't our year and wait for a new political cycle to raise it again? This is not an easy question to answer. There is, quote, more than a dime's difference between the two parties' candidates. It would be disastrous, each side no doubt believes, to lose the chance to control the White House, and that risk feels particularly urgent to those of us on the left. Even if the stalemate that is Washington were to continue throughout Obama's second term, the chance to avoid the further unraveling of the Supreme Court seems reason enough to fight like hell to assure that Romney's are only ever governors. But we must recognize that waiting is not costless either. The nature of campaign spending in the two elections since Citizens United has changed American politics fundamentally. The idea that 196 Americans, the 0.000063%, can contribute close to 80% of super PAC expenditures will seem ordinary in the years to come. If we let this issue go unremarked now, we could well pass a point of no return. We cannot afford this silence now. We cannot afford to wait. We must find a way to put these issues into the center of the presidential campaign. And the only way to do that now is the most misunderstood movement in this election cycle so far, Americans Elect. He says, for the first time in modern history, there will be a candidate on every presidential ballot in November who is not the nominee of either major party. That candidate will have been selected by voters from across the country who registered AmericansElect.com, become delegates, who reveal through a series of questions their own position on a wide range of issues. Thousands of delegates have already registered this process. In 2 weeks, the first round of candidates will have been filtered from the rest. The Commission on Presidential Debates will invite to the debates any candidate who has more than 15% support in six national polls. His argument is Americans Elect is happening, regardless of who engages or not. So it's better to engage. I'm going to try and bring him on the program to talk about this more as we go forward. But it's certainly something to think about. And for those of you who have been skeptical of Americans Elect, like I am, and I frankly continue to be, that skepticism is not necessarily justification for not engaging. Because as skeptical as you might be, the bottom line is you're going to be on the ballot. And we don't know who the candidate is going to be. It's highly unlikely it is someone who is going to take votes away from Obama, although Rocky Anderson is there. I'm not sure why Lessig doesn't really mention Rocky Anderson too much in this piece. But Buddy Romer has been far more vocal, at least about campaign finance. There's a lot of other things about Buddy Romer I don't agree with. So interesting. I would head over there. Both will put a link up to that piece by Lawrence Lessig and a link up to Americans Elect. Take a check it out for yourself. We'll have Lessig on this program later. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Rupert Murdoch in the hot seat. Should be fun. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report today. That would be Thursday morning in Britain. Rupert Murdoch was sitting in front of basically like a bland black.
Hello.
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 What? What?
I'm looking. Hello.
Well, oh, is it Rupert Murdoch? How did you just appear on? On the program like that.
That's... I'm looking for a Sam Cedar. Is Sam Cedar there?
Yeah, it's me. What?
Sam!
This is quite a coincidence, Rupert, because I was just talking about your appearance in front of the...
I'm sure everyone is. I did a good job, don't you think, Sam?
Actually, I wasn't terribly... You all right? Did you walk up a flight of stairs?
That's a jet lag. Just jet lag, Sam.
Jet lag?
Wait. I only spend 10% of my time in the United Kingdom. I'm in and out all the time.
Well, wait, you're back in the United States already?
Yes, yeah, private jet.
But weren't you? Did you say cryogenics?
Why would I say cryogenics?
I thought you said cryogenics, because I was wondering.
I said private jet, and I never want to hear about the cryogenic. It's a private jet.
private jet. Okay. Wow, that was an awful quick jet, because you were testifying this morning, and it I listened to some of the audio, and boy, I'll tell you, you really got handed to you by a couple of the guys there. Particularly Robert Jay, who's the chief interrogator of the inquiry. Do you mind?
I had a good couple good pot shots at him. I told him what's what.
You did. But let's get to that in a minute. I want to first ask you a couple of questions now that I'll be on the phone.
Sure, that's why I called, because you're my favorite interviewer, Sam. You're one of my favorite interviewers.
That's very sweet of you. Now, I want to ask you a question here, okay? You were basically, you said there was a cover-up at the News of the World, but you were actually a victim of this. Is that right?
I completely victimized. If I could be raped, Sam, that's how I feel. I'm a victim here.
I'm sorry, did you say if you could be raped, that's how you feel?
If I could be, I mean, I suppose I could be raped. But, I mean, if I were raped, I assume this is how it would feel. And this is, I am a victim of people whose names I cannot say, but who I know, who covered up this. I have to tell you, it's one of the most humble days of my life.
I have to say that you said that. You've said that before, you know. I mean,
when did it? What
you said? No, when you testified in front of the parliamentary committee, you said it was the most humble day of your life.
That's true too. Yeah, that's right.
You've had a lot of humbling days.
It's a humbling series of months. Yes, today was one of the humbling most. I'm a victim, Sam.
No, I know. You said that. Now, I want to ask you, you said, quote, "I think the senior executives were all misinformed and shielded from anything that was going on there. There's no question in my mind, maybe the evidence, but certainly beyond that, someone took charge of a cover-up, and we're all victims of that." So you're saying...
Sam, don't get gotcha with me. Don't get gotcha with me. It ended with, "and I regret it." That's the quote.
Do you regret it so much if you're such a victim?
Wouldn't you regret being a victim, Sam? I think we all can understand being a victim.
All right, fair enough. And why did you, you said that you just didn't pay attention to this.
No, I didn't.
I find that hard to believe.
I want to say, I feel like I've failed, and I'm very sorry about that, but how can I pay attention when I'm not paying attention, Sam? I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. And at one point...
No, it doesn't. Thank you, Sam. It doesn't.
I want to ask you, just at one point, Robert Jay said that News International had obstructed the initial phone hacking investigation. Mm-hmm. You said the company did no such thing.
Correct.
And he said, if we have evidence that we've had conclusively demonstrates the opposite, your reaction?
My reaction, look, we have had investigation after investigation, and we've spent a lot of money with lawyers and people like that, going through inquiry after inquiry. And I think, you know, we basically relied on the police investigation. They told us there was nothing there.
But you were bribing the police.
And you want to come forward to me and say, well, I have evidence. I'd love to see the evidence, but I'm sorry.
Well, you weren't you? What wasn't your company paying the police?
You know, Sam, you're one of my favorite interviewers. I don't know what did I do to you now? Did I do something to you now? Is that the problem?
Asking a question. That's all.
All right. Well, I didn't fly back to New York to get on your show.
You didn't need to fly back to New York. We have a phone system that we could have called.
Perhaps I panicked a little bit. I mean, that's all I can say.
You said that today too. What you panicked when you said when you shut down? You said you panicked actually when you When you shut down.
Yeah.
When you shut down news of the world.
I understand what I said. What's your point, Sam?
Well, it just sounds like a lot of this is practiced.
That's ridiculous. I'm an 81-year-old man. I don't have time or energy to practice responses. The fact is I panicked when I sold News of the World. I feel like a victim. I feel like I failed. I don't know how any of those things seem like practiced answers.
Well, let me ask you this. I'll just repeat what the investigator said. Jay said, some might say this is consistent with the desire to cover up.
Some might say that.
That's what I said. Some might say that.
No, yes, of course they might say that, and that's just not the case. Although I happen to know of two people who did the cover up that I'm not sure happened.
But you know who these people are, and you're not going to tell
us. I do, and of course, why would I give their names up? That's poor gamesmanship.
Is one of their last names start with Murdoch?
You're going to try and trick me into this, I can see. Yes, that would be true.
You said yes.
What? Sorry, who?
Well, Rupert, I want to thank you for calling in. I appreciate your clarifying this for us.
No problem.
Let me ask you this. What do you think the chances you're going to be walking the streets 6 to 8 months from now?
What are you implying, Sam?
Maybe you're going to go to jail.
Clever, Sam. That was very clever. 6 to 8 months walking the streets. I'll be fine. James will probably be locked up, but I'll be fine.
Well, that's nice that you're willing to plan for your kid's future. That's very sweet.
I need to plan for my future. I have grandchildren. They need to know I'm going to be around walking. They don't like James, so that's fine. But I have grandchildren. I have children. I've been spending most of my time with my family during all of this, and I think that's what people seem to overlook. So they say, how do you not know this? And I say, I was with my grandchildren. I was.
Do you really have grandchildren?
I'm sure I have grandchildren. I'm pretty sure of them.
At the very least, you can find.
I spent time with them, so I'm pretty sure I have them.
All right. Well, I just wanted to double check on that.
All right.
Well, Rupert Murdoch, thank you so much for calling in.
Sam, I love the show. I love the show. How you doing, Sam? You good?
Yeah. Feel free to become a member.
Oh, let's not get carried away.
Thanks for calling in.
Thank you, Sam. I love your show.
He doesn't know how to work a phone. Rupert Murdoch, everyone. Wow, that was very nice of him to call in. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire, the New Hampshire Republican-dominated House has approved medical marijuana, 236-96. The Senate passed the bill by a 13-11 vote in March. Democratic Governor John Lynch has threatened to veto the legislation, which would allow patients with a written certification from the doctor to cultivate up to 6 ounces of marijuana. It's so ridiculous. Only patients with serious chronic and terminal diseases such as cancer, AIDS, and Parkinson's would be eligible to possess marijuana. It's just, I just don't understand what the problem is here. Another interesting tact happening in California. California has been undergoing a policy experiment, a research project that started in 2007 by studies at UC San Francisco, which allowed 41 medical providers statewide, with the permission of the state and with training from the state, to perform abortions even though they're not doctors. Presumably they're midwives or nurses. The project will end this fall. Researchers had enough information last year based on 8,000 abortions to conduct an analysis, and that analysis was that there was no medical reason why they shouldn't allow non-doctors who are accredited to perform these abortions. Medically, they're very simple and rarely have complications. And now a bill has passed committee on Tuesday in California. Nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, and physician assistants would be able to perform what is known as aspiration abortion. It's the most common abortion procedure. It takes place in the first trimester of a pregnancy. The bill, SB 1338, would allow for only 41 people in the state, those 41 people, or 41 of those those 41 people who have already been trained to perform abortions. But in the event that this law is passed, you'll see far more people being trained. And essentially, it would provide greater access for women in rural regions, essentially, to have to exercise their right to terminate a pregnancy, have an abortion. So as we see some states across the country work overtime to restrict abortion, to narrow women's rights over their own bodies, at least in California, we're seeing something different. And in about 10 minutes, we're going to talk to Katrina VandenHeuvel about Unite Women and just about the general attack on women. I just find this sort of fascinating that we're seeing this type of contraction of rights. I mean, I don't know how else to refer to it. Meanwhile, two interesting stories coming out of Pennsylvania, the petri dish for the fracking industry. You know, we've talked about the fracking industry and their use of PSYOPs. Literally, former PSYOPs, special forces people or former military intelligence personnel, to go into towns and to essentially unravel the community fabric so that they have a better opportunity to lease some people's lands, even though there are other members of the community who might say, like, hey, we don't want to destroy our drinking water. We don't want to destroy the nature of the town, even though there's a couple of people who will get richer. Very often, there are a couple of people who are going to get devastated by it. Not to mention the implications of destroying a town's water supply forever. And we know that the fracking industry finds it much easier to have sway over local and county officials and state officials than even the tremendous amount of sway they have over federal officials. We know that because of the Halliburton loophole, on a federal level, fracking is not covered by the Clean Water Act, in part because they don't have to reveal what chemicals they're injecting into the ground. And so it's impossible to know that these chemicals that we find in the ground that we presume shouldn't be there are coming from the fracking because we don't know what they're using. And there's a Pennsylvania law that has recently been passed, as reported by the LA Times, essentially an amendment to a law that compels natural gas companies to give inquiring healthcare professionals information about the chemicals used in their drilling production process, but only after the doctors or nurses sign a confidentiality agreement. And this is sort of a classic case of trying to head off some major problems that these fracking companies are anticipating. The LA Times piece starts off with a story about a doctor who began treating members of a family in a working-class neighborhood about a half a mile from a natural gas well. The plastic surgeon specializes in skin cancer. The doctor biopsied a quarter-sized skin lesion from a woman and her niece. They found that it was not cancer, but they found that the lesions returned. Now, this is from the woman and her niece. And they have no idea what it is. They have no idea what these lesions are. So the doctor went to this family's neighborhood and collected urine samples from a dozen people around the neighborhood to see if this was something that was genetic or see if it was something that was perhaps environmental. She found chemicals not normally present in the human body. Hippuric acid, phenol, mandelic acid. I don't know what that is. But one has to wonder, why is it that you have all these people in the neighborhood with the same sort of uncommon chemicals in their urine? And they suspect that these chemicals are a function of the natural gas well. They can't tell because they don't know. And now the only way for this doctor to find out is to go to the fracking companies. They'll give her the information, but she needs to sign a non-disclosure form. And see how this game works here, right? If she didn't have that ability, she would then sue them. It would come out in discovery. It would be public. And then federal and local and state officials and activists could then act upon the use of those chemicals and prove that these chemicals are now present in people's bodies. These chemicals are now present in the fish. These chemicals are now present in the wells. And so they basically short-circuit that by giving the doctors an opportunity to come get it. All they have to do is sign an NDA. And basically put the liability on the doctors. So that if this information gets out, the doctors are responsible. It's just one more way in which these companies realize that the key to all of this is sort of just to go into a community and destroy the fabric of that community. It is much easier for them to get their drilling leases if there is no sort of sense of community there. And aiding and abetting them in Pennsylvania, and this is going to come as no surprise, and if you want a sense of what your future is going to look like, ladies and gentlemen, from the American Independent, two of the country's largest private water utility companies are participants in a massive lobbying effort to expand fracking. The water companies, American Water and Aqua America, are leading drinking water suppliers in Pennsylvania.
Surprise, surprise.
Where drilling is booming. They also sell water to gas companies, which use a drilling technique that requires massive amounts of water. They are also dues-paying members of the gas industry's powerful Marcellus Shale Coalition. So you see what you get here? This is what we call in radio a twofer. You sell them water to use in their fracking, which invariably destroys the water supply underground, destroys people's water wells, and then you sell those people water so they can drink. That's like me owning a guest booking agency where I charge potential guests a fee to book them on my own show. That's fantastic. EPA is currently conducting a congressionally mandated study to investigate the potential adverse impact that hydraulic fracking may have on water quality and public health. Pennsylvania is home to 3 of 7 sites selected for a nationwide study. So can't wait until that study gets suppressed by industry and their cronies, but we'll have to wait for that. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Katrina Vandenhuvel of The Nation magazine about the relentless assault on women's rights. And the marches that are taking place this weekend in, as pushback. We'll be right back after this.
I turned my camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way. The way I'm slipping away. I turned my feelings on. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah, and you wasn't alone. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton. No, no, no. Ooh, yeah. Well, I turned my feelings on. I turned my feelings on the side. Yeah, yeah, like I'm gonna ignite. I saw them stars go off. I saw them stars go off tonight. Ooh, yeah, yeah. And I'm looking right. Right.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome back to the program the editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, Katrina Vandenheuvel. Katrina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
So, Katrina, we have this weekend UniteWomen.org, which is going to be holding marches across the country, responding to... I mean, you tell me if this is unprecedented. I mean, certainly in the past, I don't know, 10 years, has there ever been a year where there has been this much sort of aggressive, suppression of women's rights, curtailing of women's rights?
An attack on women's rights. I mean, an attack, Sam, think about this. I thought the whole contraception issue was kind of settled. I mean, you know, I understand that the choice abortion issue is one that continues to roil our politics, but contraception, you know, basic access to health care via Planned Parenthood, a group that is about as, you know, American as apple pie, with one out of six women going there for basic health care services. But I do think you're right. This is a year in which we've seen unprecedented attack on women's rights, their bodies, their ability to control their own bodies, health care. But it reminds me of 1992, right? The year that many called the year of the women, because of that image one cannot forget of Anita Hill testifying before that, I believe, all-male judiciary committee, mm-hmm. and the attacks on her. Because we saw that in a similar way 2012 when Sandra Fluke, mm-hmm. testified before an all-male committee and was subjected to ugly attacks, and Rush Limbaugh vented his odious words. So it reminds me of 1992, and I think there's always, if I might, you know, take a bright outlook here, which is hard, but the silver lining is it's really galvanized millions of women to understand they need to stand up, and not just women, but with their allies, men, children, citizens of conscience, but stand up and fight again for their rights, because the history of freedom in this country, as you know, Sam, is one of constant vigilance and struggle.
I mean, it's interesting. You know, when we talk about 92, I realize now that's 20 years ago, and that was when Pat Buchanan got up in the Republican convention and said, you know, we're in the midst of a culture war. And, you know, Dan Quayle is criticizing a fictional TV character for having a child, out of wedlock. You know, that's 20 years ago. And
these things come in. But, you know, these things come and go. There's kind of a strand in the political DNA in our country. But more, I think when you see Well, first of all, the Republican Party hijacked by a right-wing wrecking crew, and the Tea Party, by the way, interestingly claiming it was committed to fiscal issues, not that interested in social conservative issues, coming, you know, forward and allying with social conservatives, evangelicals. I think when a country is in tectonic change, which I believe this country is, certainly demographically, you have people, particularly the Tea Party, looking out at these changes, looking out at modernity, not liking what they see and fighting back quite vigorously. And that's where you get this kind of culture war syndrome. If I could, I've always loved what Molly Ivins, the late, great Molly Ivins, said about Pat Buchanan's 1992 culture war speech, which was that it was better in the original German, but I'll stop. But the culture wars, listen, the culture wars also arise when, and I'm not just, I don't want to get partisan here, but when you got a Republican Party which doesn't have a way to address what is affecting millions of women, where are they on pay equality? Where are they on affordable health care? Where are they on contraception? And where are they on, like, sick payday leaves? And then, I'll stop, you get a candidate like Rick Santorum, who is the classic culture war candidate. So he comes into the primaries and just reopens this ferocious debate, Romney, as you can see, is pivoting as fast as he can away from it. But as someone said, you know, Etch-a-Sketch is tough to do in a video era.
Right. Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, first off, Santorum was almost sort of like, I mean, I think the reason why Santorum became such a lightning rod on these issues is actually because of what happened with the Komen Foundation, and you know, which predated that. You know, so this is going beyond. Well, I don't know if it's going beyond electoral politics, but I think you're right about this. You know, this is a sort of, maybe not the last gasp, but some last gasps of people sort of, you know, white-knuckled, hanging on to the way that society was structured 50
years
ago.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely, Sam, when you look at the statistics about how many women are in the workforce, well, if their jobs aren't being cut because they work in the public sector and they happen to live in a state controlled by Republican governors and legislators, but women are in the workforce. Women are in politics. Women are, in many ways, you know, not in the home, as they're not homeschooling their kids in ways Rick Santorum wanted. So there is not, you know, again, if there is this overarching feel of a retro moment in which the culture wars fit and feed, and there is, I would argue, the bigger picture is an attempt in some ways to roll back the civilizing advances of the 20th century, economically and socially. So you have in this extremist Republican Party an attempt to roll back the gains of the New Deal. Mm-hmm. And you see in Rick Santorum and the 21st century social conservatives an attempt once again to control women's bodies and how they lead their lives and make their living. So it's an interesting moment. The interesting thing is, one thing that has remained consistent, and I hope I get this right, is but since 1980, the Republicans have, in presidential elections, always lost out on the gender gap. Women consistently have voted against Republicans. Now, that gaping gender gap we saw just maybe a week ago is closing. We can talk about the silliness of spending 36 to 48 good hours of our already trivialized, not you, Sam, of course, media time on the Ann Romney, Hillary Rosen flap gate, as opposed to serious issues. But on the other hand, that did illuminate some of the ongoing culture war problems in this country.
All right. Well, let's, you know, the Republicans, you know, I think I just saw a headline before I went on the program today that the Republicans have graciously said that they will not filibuster passage of of an amended Women's Against Violence Act, which I think is very big of them.
That's gracious of them.
But why are we not seeing as much from the Democrats and from the Obama administration on the things you're talking about, like paid leave, like daycare, for instance.
Because we have an administration which, well, reformist in decent ways. For example, signing Lilly Ledbetter Pay Equality Act is one of the first moves in the Obama administration, is, as I think we'd agree, it's not producing change in policy at the scale needed to meet the scale of the problems we face. So if you're constrained by what I would argue is a kind of elite consensus about what the real problems of this country are, for example, the debt and deficit,
right,
as opposed to truly building a job-led recovery in which people have good jobs, in which you're investing in really important ways in this country, and not, you know, giving banks low interest rates, zero interest rates, instead of giving students zero interest rates on their loans, you got this problem. So you got a Republican Party that's basically refighting culture wars, attacking women, I'd argue, and their rights, but you got a Democratic Party for the most part. I do think within the Democratic Party, as has always been the case, it's, you got coalitions, because since we're a poor country and only have two main parties, within certainly the Democratic Party, you got a progressive caucus of about 80 people who I think are consistently on the right side in terms of principles and values. But, you know, you got a White House which is not full-throated in terms of some of the economic issues, which I think are so critical for women and families and people to
right.
live their lives fully.
And I mean, so how does a left, I mean, I imagine this is a question that beleaguers you on a daily basis as it does me, but how does a progressive left in this country, are they simply by ultimately voting for Obama, because when you go into that booth, are they simply basically disempowering themselves?
No, here's my small theory of progressive politics. First of all, voting is the first step. It's the first step. And then the hard work follows. Holding politicians accountable, organizing around issues you care about, working with the movements of one's time to ensure that those in elected office are pushed, whether it's a president or a council member. And my passion at the moment, in light of what we've learned, though we've known for more than a decade about the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, is building a counterforce to ALEC. And there is movement underway. I wrote about this at thenation.com last week, with state legislators around this country allied with the Progressive Caucus to build a counterforce so that you have people fighting at all levels for policies progressives care about. So I think it's movement. It's you got to do both. You got to do what I would say inside, outside. You got people inside who can be pushed, and you got to build that outside momentum and movement. And that's where I think Occupy Wall Street, the 99% movement, have been so important. And the hope is that in coalition, and sure, Occupy, no interest in electoral politics, that's its right. But it is interested, for example, in getting money out of politics, which is critical to a different electoral system. And that Occupy spirit has given new energy to, for example, overturning the despicable Citizens United decision, which has polluted our politics.
Exactly. Well, there are marches going on across the country. People can go to unitewomen.org for more information. And, I still can't get over sort of just how naked this has been by the right in this country. And on some level, I mean, I guess they just can't help themselves.
I think it's being exposed, though. We had an editorial meeting here about an hour ago, and no one's predicting the Tea Party's demise by any measure. And it's been, as I said earlier, I mean, it's been sort of Tea Party is now in Congress, Paul Ryan, et cetera. But someone did a survey a few weeks ago showing the Tea Party is less popular than a group I like than the atheists of this country. So I think the Tea Party may be reaching an interesting limit. And that's something to pay attention to.
But isn't that just a question of branding? I mean, isn't that, wasn't the Tea Party always just the same people in the Republican Party, the electoral base of the Republican Party. It's just that at one point they just changed their name, essentially.
It's a good question, Tim. And, I mean, I was on this panel last week about the changing faces of the right. Oh, I think you could take the Tea Party lineage and, you know, you could head back to the John Birch Society.
Of course.
You do the Christian Coalition. You do, you know, we've been talking about
the moral majority.
The moral majority. But on the other, and then you also, you know, you have strands of Ross Perot. You have, you know, you have strands of many right-wing populist movements, but populist movements fused or funded by the right-wing elite. Now, I'd say one thing that I do think what's different is we see the power of the 40-year right-wing march through our institutions, which was illuminated. Bill Moyers wrote a piece for us last November about the Powell memo. Your listeners should check it out. The Powell memo, written by Lewis Powell, who became a Supreme Court judge 2 months after he wrote it, was really written in response, if people can believe this, to a fear that, you know, liberalism was on the ascent, the regulatory state was reaching a critical mass, Ralph Nader was having impact, so the corporations had to push back. Chamber of Commerce commissioned the memo, and it led to a network, a nexus of right-wing think tanks, Heritage, Bradley, to publications, to speakers and pundits. It led to the creation of ALEC. So I think that right-wing march through our institutions has reached a critical point. We see it in the Supreme Court we have today, et cetera. And that's where the Tea Party is. Yes, the lineage is there, but it's also playing a different role because the political culture is different. And I think what used to be considered extreme right-wing is too often considered conservative by the media. The media has also shifted and is playing a different role than it did 20, 25 years ago. Not that the progressive infrastructure of the media, your show, I hope The Nation, thenation.com, haven't risen and developed, but you still have this mindset in, forget Fox, but like CNN, accepting what used to be considered far more conservative is now treated as mainstream.
You know, I would argue in some instances, not just on CNN as well, but also MSNBC.
I agree. And we don't hear enough, by the way, on MSNBC, nor do we hear enough from cable news generally. I think about what, you know, about national security, foreign policy, which can't be extricated in my mind from what's going on inside this country.
Our policy on Czechoslovakia has been horrible.
Don't get me going. I'm telling you, man. You get me going on NATO, where the summit in Chicago, May 1820. NATO should have been abolished. Excuse me. It was formed to counter the Warsaw Pact. The Cold War is over. We think Alan West, naming 78 to 81 communists, may disagree because he's a fool.
Right.
But, yeah, don't get me going.
All right. Well, Katrina Van Den Heuvel, editor
you,
and publisher of The Nation, I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Shall we go for 15 minutes? She didn't get my joke about Czechoslovakia. She's obviously not, like, reading the Czechoslovakia. She's probably getting off the phone going, like, God, Sam still think Czechoslovakia exists? I was going to say something, but then, you know, what am I going to do? Sam still, God. Sam's very good on domestic politics, but he still thinks Czechoslovakia exists. I should have followed that up with, like, in our policy on Prussia. Forget about it. Those Turks in the Ottoman Empire. Let's just go. I don't know. We'll have to reconfigure it and figure out when we're going to put in. But folks, become a member of the show. Look, maybe we'll just do a freebie today. It's all over the place. It'll be easier. Let's just do it. I know that runs contrary to, you know, you don't want to be sitting there, folks, listening to the sound of my voice and saying, you know what I'm doing? I'm taking advantage of the fact that Sam's a very bad business person. You don't want that on your conscience. All the other horrible things that we all have to do every day just to get by. Oh, I'm going to, I don't know. I'm using a product by a company that is horrible. I'm not buying all American clothes, so some of it's inevitably made by sweatshops. I'm using my iPhone. It's horrible. All of these things. You don't want to add to it by saying, like, I'm also taking advantage of Sam being such a bad business person. You don't need that on your, you don't need that type of pressure, believe me. Let's go to Bush and Chains on the IM. Glenn Greenwald, Obama's explanation for his medical marijuana crackdown reveals his sense of justice and belief in the rule of law. Obama escalates the war in Yemen again. Media whore Grampy McCain rips Schumer for being on TV too much. Rick Scott's drug testing of state workers ruled unconstitutional. Oh, I'm glad to hear that. And Limbaugh says Hillary Clinton not successful because she's just a secretary. Oh, that had to have been a joke. And Secret Service linked to another prostitution scandal. Wow. You can IM me at Majority FM for those of you who are not aware. And, of course, we got a call. we'll take that call in just a moment. Bear with us as we gear up here. You can call us at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Or if you prefer to use your Skype device, and I've recently put Skype on my phone because we have no reception in this office. If you prefer to use Skype, you can Skype us at Majority Live. That's Majority Live on your Skype device. I'm trying to use it right now, and it won't let me. Great. My Skype's not working. You got to be kidding me. I'm having one of those days. One of those really horrible days. Tomorrow, of course, will be Friday. And Cliff Schechter, as always, will be joining us on the program. Have not figured out yet who is going to be the film person for tomorrow. Maybe it'll be Johnny Galecki. Do you know who Johnny Galecki is? He's on that show. Well, first of all, he was the kid on Roseanne. Now he's all grown up, and he's on that show, that CBS sitcom.
Big Bang Theory?
Yeah.
I love that show.
You do?
I know who Oh, that'd be awesome.
Would you be excited about that?
I'd be very excited. I'm a big fan. I'm a huge fan. Huge with a capital Y.
Well, he just sent me a text with him giving me the finger. So I think he and Richard Kind both giving me the finger on text.
His name just went over my head. I don't know why. Well, I'm a big fan.
Let's go to A Square. Sam was talking to husband last night about death of news. I was talking? Oh, you were talking to the husband last night about death of news and Facts Media. Another reason why Majority reporting Up with Chris are now a must for us. Your interview with Mann on climate wars was another great one. I had never heard such a clear and succinct frame to refer to the right attack on science. The Serengeti strategy. And as you noted, a frame of attack applies to other areas as well. Always happy to be a Cedarista. Well, you know, you're going to get one of these. Let's go to the phones. Kaiser Zose, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sammy.
How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good, Sammy. Long show today. I took today off. You got all this free content. My day is done. It's great.
Yeah, there you go, buddy. So I got word. We have one of our Majority Report drones flying over your place of work. We saw that you got out. And...
Fantastic. Hey, I just wanted to call. And great shows last week. I know you must have come back from Vegas a little disappointed with all the money you lost. But,
yes.
You know, really solid. Solid interviews this week, and just like I just wanted to comment on, you know, with this Rubio thing and just, you know, the teleprompter attack. It's such a political strategy that the right uses. It's like they always attack what's best about that candidate to make it a weakness. And you know, like with teleprompter, like he's the best order we have in the last 20 years probably. So let's mock him and take that down a notch. And you know, if you go back to 2004 with Kerry, I mean, the Swift voting of Kerry, which is probably the most disgusting display of political tactic I've ever seen. You know, my dad was in Vietnam, and I don't think that what they did there was even close to patriotic, or it was disgusting. But it was Kerry's strength, and it made it a weakness.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. I mean, the right. I mean, just imagine you're in the room. You're the candidate. You're in a room with your advisors, and they're like, "We're going to attack Romney, and we're going to attack Obama for using a teleprompter." And the candidate goes, "Well, but you know, I use a teleprompter." And they go, "Yeah, so
exactly.
So what? No, but don't you understand? I use a teleprompter. So if we're criticizing Obama for using a teleprompter, won't that come back on me?
Yeah.
Nah.
Yeah, he goes. Yeah, he goes to the bathroom. Let's attack him.
It's really amazing. What's amazing is they get away with it.
Yeah. Like, when I saw you were at the 2004 convention, because I ordered the DVD, and when you saw those old ladies with these Band-Aids with purple hearts.
No, they had purple fingers on, wait, didn't they have, like, what was it? They had the, oh, right. They were mocking his purple heart.
Yeah. Like, never mind the silver star, but, you know, okay, so he was in, you know, he took fire. The way he got a purple heart was ridiculous. So that's a negative. And I think you're kind of seeing that too, like, how they're trying to, you know, with the whole war on women thing, they used that one, like, analyst's, like, saying that Ann Romney didn't work a day in her life. Now they're saying that the right is attacking women, or there's a war on women. It's just right. So obvious.
Well, you know, I don't think this, the whole thing with the Hillary Rosen thing, I don't think that got much traction. But all right, guys,
they ran it forever. Anyway, keep up the good fight. Love you, man.
Appreciate it.
Sorry I didn't win the Mega Millions for you.
Well, what are you going to do? Thanks for trying.
Vegas, baby.
Thanks for trying. Let's go to Rye Pop. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Hey. How you doing, Sam?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
We're picking up a little delay.
We're picking up a little bit of delay. Are you listening
wanted to bring up the fact that when you and Katrina were talking about Anita Hill, in 1992, we still dealt with Bob Packwood. He was a very interesting character as a senator and a misogynistic bastard on top of anything else. These are not different people today in the Republican Party. These are the same exact people. Even with handwriting in his own personal diaries, these attacks on women that he made, he threatened the Democratic Party with hearings that would condemn them. It was the most amazing thing. And then to watch the Democrats continue to lay down, the only thing we had that was a benefit was Kennedy.
He
kicked back.
Yeah.
I'm going to shut up now.
All right. Well, Rye Pop, I appreciate the call. I know we got a little bit of a lag. But yes. Well, the thing is that, you know, but these people may be the same people, but it's just unbelievable that they can't help themselves. I mean, strategically, I don't know. I have a bit of a theory that their racism would have been more overt and intense over these past three years, had, let's say, Clinton been president, and the misogyny would have been tamped down. I don't know. I mean, I'm speculating, but I wonder if there's any bone in their head that basically says, like, hey, wait a second, maybe attacking these people make us look like we're Neanderthals. Neanderthals apparently did not have mirrors. This is the one thing I know about Neanderthals. They did not have mirrors. Cool J146. Ever wonder where your old electronic ends up? Answer is horrible. The third world makes our electronics. We use it, then it gets sent back and dumped on them. Most children in the city who were studied have lead poisoning in the city where most foreign waste is brought into China. Ugh, horrible. Can you do an interview on the PSYOPs operation on fracking victims? There isn't any in-depth coverage of this as far as I know. It was just mentioned in passing in one or two articles. I did.
I did interview the people who uncovered it, I think at DeSmog Blog, and I think it was Brendan DeMille, I think I interviewed on this program, DeMille. Search PSYOP, search fracking, that's why we need more tags, on the site, or DeSmog Blog on majority.fm. May 1st is next Tuesday. Any news on the general strike? I know that there's talk that perhaps on the Golden Gate Bridge, union workers on the bridge are going to work with Occupy to perhaps shut that bridge down. I have not heard of anything specifically in New York. I have a feeling those details will become, but we're going to start to dig into it and try and find some people to speak to and find out what's going on in New York. We got to figure out what we're going to do on that day. So right now, I think I get Eric Alterman booked for his new book, The Cause, which is actually a great book and perhaps worthwhile on that day, but maybe, I don't know. We have to figure it out. And Tim Johnson in Chicago will be the last IM of the day, ladies and gentlemen, as we are running out of time. A recent poll named Cambodia the least happy country on earth because it came in last in a poll that asked the question, are you thriving? Highest in the poll was Norway at 75%. Lowest in the poll was Cambodia with only 2% of its population thriving. With such disparity and desperation, is it little wonder every evil thrives here? All right, we'll do one more. Crystal Count, tangential to Lessig's Americans elect push to fight corruption in politics. What's your take on the prospects for Jenks Wolfpack, which is seeking a constitutional amendment to take away corporate personhood and thus get big corporate politicians out of government? This means is to build a movement at the state level and calls for a constitutional convention. I think constitutional changes are unlikely, but I don't think organizing around them is a bad idea. If that were to happen, it would be good. I support the organizing around these things. All right, folks, that's our program for today. Join us tomorrow when it will be Friday. And I will be here, so will Cliff and somebody else. I'll be seeing you then. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. You'd see the truth in the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my